Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and thank you for joining us for this episode of New Books in Philosophy, which is a channel that is part of the New Books Network. I'm Robert Talese, and I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I co-host the program with Carrie Figder, Malcolm Keating, and Sarah Tyson. My guest today is Charlotte Witt. Charlotte is professor of philosophy at the University of New Hampshire. Much of her work engages issues at the intersections of metaphysics, social philosophy, and feminist philosophy. But in addition, I suppose I'm not alone in knowing her work on Aristotle's metaphysics, including an early book about substance and essence in Aristotle's metaphysics. Now, her latest book has just been published with Oxford University Press. It's titled Social Goodness, The Ontology of Social Norms. In her day-to-day lives, we're subject to normative requirements, obligations, and even expectations that originate in the social roles that we occupy. For example, professors ought to pursue the truth, while parents ought to be supportive of their children. What's interesting is that these role-specific requirements seem in many cases to just befall us. And that raises the puzzle of what accounts for their normativity. Now, in her book, Social Goodness, Charlotte proposes a novel, I would say intriguing conception, of the nature of social norms and the source of their normativity. The centerpiece of her account is the idea that we need to look to various examples of artisanal practices, dispositions, and techniques in order to understand the norms that attach to our social roles. Now, as usual, there's a whole lot to talk about. But also, as usual, we will begin with our guest. Hello, Charlotte.
Hi, Bob.
How are you today?
I'm excellent. How about you?
I'm doing good. I'm glad to hear that you're excellent. And since you are excellent, tell us a bit about yourself.
Well, let's see. I was born in Helsinki, Finland, because my dad worked for the State Department.
It's a beautiful city.
It is a beautiful city, and I've had the opportunity to go back in a philosophical context on several occasions, and I've really enjoyed those visits.
Yeah.
And since my dad was in the State Department, my upbringing was pretty involved a lot of moving from one culture to another. And I actually was reflecting prior to this interview, and I was thinking that I think that that had something to do with my always finding social norms intriguing and somewhat quirky. In other words, having moved from, say, the U.S. to Africa, there were just different sets of norms that you had to be fairly nimble to pick up, especially if you were a student. A child as I was. So for example, just as one example, I went to a school called St. Cyprian's School for Girls in Cape Town through middle school and the beginning of high school. And at St. Cyprian's School for Girls, when the teacher walked in the room, you stood up and you were quiet. That's what you did. And if a teacher spoke to you, that's what you did. That's what you ought to do. When I came back to the U.S., I went to Bethesda Chevy Chase High School, which was a large suburban high school. And I could remember the first day standing up when the teacher walked in the room and sort of slowly getting back into my seat and thinking, okay, this is going to be a different set of norms, a different set of ought tos. So one of the interesting things about social norms is that on the one hand, they're things you ought to do, but on the other hand, they're very local. And I think my early upbringing helped me to have those questions.
Right. And I guess one other way in which your interest in social norms might connect with some of these early experiences is that social normativity is often, although it's operative and sort of structures our behavior, social norms are sometimes very hard to detect in our own case. Mm-hmm. We don't see them until you've got a contrast class. Does that seem right?
Oh, that's absolutely right. They're almost one of the other interesting things about them is that they're fairly tacit until someone does the wrong thing, until someone breaks the norm. And then you can see that, in fact, the norm was in play. So, yes, that's right.
Right. And just to follow up, just before we get to the meat of the book, I'm intrigued by this story of the etiology of the interest, which is that, you know, the people's reactions to the failure to comply with the norm, or to the failure to respect the norm, is also a puzzle, isn't it? Because they're tacit, as you say, or not fully legible to us, that it's, you know, that when somebody, you know, breaks the cue or cuts the line, right, that people react. So in a way, you know, low level, low key, punitively, but still that they react sort of automatically to this, you know, hard to articulate, you know, set of behavioral tendencies, or maybe they're more like requirements. That's also puzzling, isn't it?
I think it's puzzling, given the fact that one wasn't aware of it beforehand.
Right. Yeah,
it is because, you know, it's like a rip in the fabric of the social world. Suddenly, a tiny rip. I mean, there are much bigger rips, but it's a tiny rip, but an actual rip, and it's noticeable. And people react quite strongly, sometimes less strongly. But for example, you and I have roles, and right now you're the interviewer, I'm the author, and, you know, if I decide to go down and make lunch, or I don't know what all, or you decided to do the interview while you were grading, or I don't know, as long as I didn't know you were grading, it would be okay. Zoom norms are very interesting. You know, teaching on Zoom norms, right. That's a whole development,
right.
And that involves things like teaching while you're eating lunch or whatever.
That's right.
But as long as no one knows about it, then that's one thing, but there can be quite a sharp reaction when norm is breached.
I remember, again, we'll get to the book in one second. I remember at some point in the not too distant past being interested in norms about line cutting and queuing and these kinds of things. And I don't know if it was in Bicchieri. I mean, it was in some, I remember reading some empirical stuff about sort of disapproving, you know, sort of low key, again, punitive attitudes, punishing attitudes about line cutters were no less activated and prominent in people whose interests weren't set back at all by the line cutter.
Yeah.
So
mm-hmm.
people who are standing in front of the position on the line where the line is cut still want to punish the line cutter, even though they're, you know. So again, it doesn't look like these norms are about our sort of raw brute interests, even.
Right. They're not purely instrumental.
Right. Good. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's something I talk about in the book. It's kind of fascinating. And this is one facet of the non-instrumentality that you can really object, even if it doesn't have any instrumental value for you or for some project you're working on, or, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah. It's very interesting.
My wife is not a philosopher. She's not an academic, but she's very, interested in social rules, and it's not uncommon if we're driving somewhere and if she, for example, sees somebody not pick up after their pet, for her to roll down the window and yell, "We're trying to have a civilization here."
Indeed, we are.
So there's a, like I said, there's a lot to talk about. This is all very fascinating stuff. So, but why don't we begin, actually talking about the book rather than sort of talking around it. I'd like to begin with the sort of big picture that sort of is directing the inquiry here. Your book tries to resolve, or, you know, begins to offer an account to resolve what you call the great puzzle about social norms. And you refer to a quote by Liz Anderson, and that quotation frames the discussion, I think. The Anderson quote says something to the effect of, you know, the puzzle of social norms doesn't have to do with the fact that people are so disposed to comply with them, but rather the puzzle has to do with the source of their normativity, that's the more fundamental sort of philosophical concern. Once you understand that they, in fact, embody a kind of normative force of their own, you can explain why people generally comply fairly readily. So at the heart of your answer that you develop in Social Goodness is the idea that social normativity is attached to social roles. Now, can you fill in some of the background that's sort of driving, you know, your reaction, your approach to the puzzle?
Yeah. So one thing I'd like to do is start by kind of clarifying the question. It's rather narrow focus, and it might be overly narrow focus, but I found articulated in Anderson's question, how do shared standards of conduct ever acquire their normativity to begin with, as really the core puzzle for me about them, what I was really fundamentally interested in. So let me differentiate that question, which is the question I also use the phrase normative oomph.
Right.
In other words, I'm not so interested in, although it is very interesting, and in other projects I would be interested in, the content of the norms, you know, the content of various social norms is going to be determined and explained through a historical story having to do with material conditions and so on. And so content questions, while not fascinating, were not the questions that I was going to look at in this project. Instead, I really wanted to know why there were any oughts attaching to any of these social norms. It was mysterious to me. In other words, the content, while I may not know for a given social norm where it came from, I have an idea about how you could look that up. For example, I was thinking about gay marriage and the changes around norms around marriage, in addition to the legal change, but I was interested in the change around norms. And I was thinking, well, there's probably a good book to be written there, or several books sort of tracing out how this happened. But that I want to bracket the question of content. And I also want to bracket the question of what, by virtue of what kind of criteria, do you occupy a social position? So you could call those entrance conditions or membership conditions. So for example, we're both professors, we're both academics. A question you might have is, well, by virtue of what are you an academic, right? By virtue of what feature, by virtue of what status, by virtue of what accomplishment, or however one thinks about it, do you enter that category such that you're then responsive to certain norms? So I was interested in this question of the normative oomph of social norms, and not either their content, which of course I agree is quite interesting, but not the question I'm interested in this book, and also not the question, how is it that you become an academic? What are the admission criteria for membership in a social kind? So I was interested in this particular question. And part of it, part of my interest in this oomph question, had to do with my having written a book about that centrally used the notion of gender roles and gender norms. And I was interested in where the ought-tos of gender norms originated, came from, how to understand them. Is it really a question just of one's choice, one's endorsement, or is something else going on? So this relatively narrow question is connected to broader questions in social philosophy that arose when I was thinking about gender roles.
Great. I'm sorry, please continue.
No, I'm not sure whether that was an answer to your question.
No, it's perfectly good. is part of the great puzzle, or to what extent is the puzzle that you're fundamentally concerned with? What does it have to do with the sense in which the social norms seem to befall us? They don't look like they're the product of some, you know, some agreeing, somebody we didn't take up, you know. So certainly whatever the right story is of how one becomes an academic, and whatever the right story is of what the contents are of the special distinctive, you know, requirements and expectations and obligations of academics may be, some of those requirements, expectations, obligations are of a kind that it, you know, they weren't outlined on the contract you signed with the university, for example, right? But you're bound by them. Is that part of the puzzle that we're assailed by these norms? Maybe that's not, that they befall us?
Yes, that they befall us. And partly I was interested, and this Bicchieri is also interested in this, in social role nonconformity.
Right.
So I was interested in both, you know, social norms that seem to befall you, or you know, you didn't ask to have them, but also that gets displayed in people not conforming to them.
Right.
So I was interested both in the fact, and I felt that any story you wanted to tell would have to accommodate both of these things. Namely, that it's the case that we seem to come under these norms. We seem to be come responsive to and valuable under these norms without that being our plan, so to speak, on the one hand. But on the other hand, there is, of course, nonconformity to norms.
Right.
So you could, by virtue of being a professor, have a norm that you're supposed to evaluate your students with some form of exam or paper or something like this. And you could decide that you don't want to do that, that you don't think that that's a good way to do it. And so you could reject the norm. So I wanted a story that incorporated both of these features, the kind of fallenness, the, you know, the fact that you just find yourself with a bunch of obligations on the one hand, but that on the other hand, it's very important that we can be critical of and be nonconforming.
Great.
Yeah.
So that helps set the background in place, I think, really nicely. So let's talk about the architecture of your positive view. It seems to me that it's got two sort of core features. The first is that it's an externalist view, and secondly, it has it proposes, and I think makes a deeply compelling case for what you call the artisanal model of social norms. But let's take up the first thing first, which is also the first feature that's laid out in the book, which is the externalist character of your conception. Now, noting that. You know, we always say to our students, I suspect, that internalism and externalism are terms that, you know, are at home in lots of different philosophical discourses, and they don't have a common meaning across all of the places in which those words fit in. So can you tell us a little bit about the internalism-externalism distinction as they figure into this specific topic of how to explain social normativity?
Yes, I'd really be happy to do that, but I want to start with one prior question.
Excellent.
So a prior question is the following. There are ways of thinking about social norms such that you don't really have a puzzle about the source of their normativity, the ought-to-do-ness. And two of those ways, which I think are important and importantly different, look at social norms merely as prudential,
right?
That you follow social norms to avoid punishment, for example. The other way is to think about social norms as really applied ethics. In other words, what there really is normatively is ethical norms.
I see.
And if, and so social norms are really just ethical norms that are applied to very concrete situations. So for example, fairness is an ethical norm or a political norm, we might say. And when it's in terms of line jumping, you know, the application would be it's just not fair. Line jumping isn't fair. So it's an ethical problem. It's not really a social, there's no separate social normative problem lurking there. Now, I don't think either of these approaches are adequate to the phenomenon of that we experience with social norms. First of all, having them be prudential, merely prudential, it's just not the case that social norm, the ought to do-ness of social norms can be explained in terms of prudential outcomes or avoiding punishment, because people often follow social norms or feel obligated to social norms, even if they're going to be punished. I mean, it just doesn't go with the phenomenon. People will suffer quite a bit in order to uphold social norms that they think they ought to uphold. And secondly, with regard to applied ethics, social norms aren't all ethical. They couldn't possibly be explained in terms of an application of an ethical norm. So it can't, they can't inherit their normativity from ethics. That's what I want to say. And so the first step that I do is to sort of say, is there anything to understand here? Well, if you thought either the prudential view or the applied ethics view was right, the answer might be no. We have our account. So my first step in the argument was to sort of say, no, there is a peculiar kind of normativity, let's call it social normativity, that isn't assimilable to either of the other two. Does this make sense?
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Okay. So that was step one. Step one was, yes, there's something to talk about. Liz Anderson and I aren't nuts. There's something to be puzzled about, you know.
Always a good first move. There's something to talk about.
There's something to talk. I can, well, having given talks now for the last 9 months or however long it's been since the book's been out, there is a significant group of people who go for applied ethics, the applied ethics.
I see.
I think the only kind of normativity in society is ethical normativity. It's very interesting. I don't do ethics, so I mean this is all ontology to me. So,
I see.
You know. Anyway. Okay, so when I started to read and think about how to organize my thoughts about the source of social normativity as I was reading, I came up with basically two different approaches, and I call them internalism and externalism. So as I use the terms, an internalist thinks that social normativity enters the world through the attitudes of the persons who are subject to the norms. Now, the kinds of attitudes that carry the norms, as it were, or our response or the explanation for the norms differ in different versions of these theories, such that, you know, people might say, wait, these views don't have anything in common, but I'll explain in a minute how I think all the internalists kind of hang together. And then externalists like myself ground social normativity in the social world, in its positions or in its institutions or in its larger architecture, that is not in individual attitudes. So let me go back to internalism, which again is the view that I'm going to argue against. Would you like to hear more about that?
Yeah.
Or?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. So you mentioned Beccheri. Bicchieri has what I call the conditional preference view. I think she calls it the conditional preference view too.
I think that's right. Yeah,
which is good. I got that right. so it's the idea that that social norms, that the normativity of social norms comes from people's preferences, given that the preferences satisfy certain conditions. So it's kind of a neo-Humean view,
right,
that the moral ought, this is the social ought, comes from the preferences of individuals, given that they satisfy certain knowledge conditions, is basically what the conditions are. So I ought to do X because I prefer to do X, given what I know about what my community is going to think about that, right, basically. And so that's a kind of a neo-Humean view. Another version of internalist, and the reason it's internalist is that it's rooted in the preferences of individuals,
right,
basically. Another version of internalism is a kind of Kantian view, where the ought comes from self-legislation, that you give yourself a principle, that you give yourself a law that you ought to follow. And that and as a representative of that view, I discuss Christine Korsgaard.
Right.
And then somewhat more complicatedly, typically, it being Hegelian,
right,
I cite Brandom's view that, and I like the view, and I think it's very close to true. I think of the three, it's the closest, and I'll tell you why. But so Brandom has this idea that we grant authority to some other to tell us what to do, basically. But what makes it internalist is that the obligation is grounded in my authority, my giving over to you power to, I don't know, pass laws or make rules and so on and so forth. So the content of the norm is external, but the initial oomph comes from the subject. And that's why I put it over on the internalist view. I don't know whether that makes sense, but anyway,
makes
sorry,
good
go
sense.
Ahead.
I mean, it's characteristically Hegelian. It's sort
right.
of a little bit from this box and a little bit from
a bit from that box. Exactly.
That's right. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Very good. Yeah.
And that gives it a certain amount of strength, I think.
Yeah.
Anyway, right. So those are the internalists, and there probably are more versions of it. There actually are more versions of it. There's a view that says the normative oomph comes from individuals taking a normative attitude towards the rule.
Yeah.
Slightly different. Anyway, that's another internalist possibility. So externalists, in contrast, think that there's something about the structure of human societies and human institutions that ground the normative oomph of social norms, basically. And this is so, that is to say, social norms can have normative oomph quite independently of whatever the attitudes are of the individuals in question. And I think that's a big insight about what social normativity is like. It goes back to the beginning of this conversation we've had, where you were talking about how we just sort of find ourselves with these
right.
obligations. And I think that externalism captures that quite well.
Right.
Because the oomph is independent of the attitudes of the individuals, the source of the oomph.
Right. Can you, let me just interject for a second, but your externalism, you know, to be an externalist in the way that you're using the term,
right,
doesn't require anyone, doesn't one require one to deny that there are sort of internal components of one's comportment towards the social norms one finds one
of.
Okay, good, good, good.
Yeah,
I'm just wondering if the Brandomite might say, hey, wait, yours is a mixed view too.
I think the mixture is important.
Yeah.
And it's almost, where do you start?
That's good. That's
like, I start externalist.
That's right.
Brandom starts internalist and goes externalist. And I start externalist and go internalist. Because as you know, from later chapters of my book, I develop ways in which, you know, individuals are involved is a neutral word, but you know what I'm saying, have input, as it were, or are able to improve or criticize or whatever social norms. Yes, that's a really good point. I hadn't thought of it quite that way. Yeah. Well,
fantastic. And, you know, Hegelian triumphalists love to do that kind of thing. Like, oh, yours, your view is just like mine, too. So, you know,
well, fortunately,
beware.
There are so few Hegelians on the ground. I haven't heard that yet. I hear the Kantian view is more out there.
Okay. Yeah. That's a very helpful way of sort of characterizing the internalism and externalism. Can we talk now about the sort of artisanal model? Because once you say that, you know, you start in thinking about these social norms in these externalist terms, they don't have their source in our endorsement or even our reflective endorsement or our consent or choosing or signing on. Then it comes, okay, well, what's the right model for thinking about how these norms function? Mm-hmm. And so you develop this, I suspect you won't mind me calling it sort of neo-Aristotelian, picture of how these norms, understood as an externalist understands them, sort of attached to us or befall us. And I'm particularly interested in the new term you coined, which is afunction, afunction. So can you sort of fill in the artisanal model and the afunction, which, if I'm remembering correctly, is short for Aristotelian function. Is that right?
Yes, the A function is Aristotle function, Aristotelian function. And I use it to refer to the ergon, or the work that something does, and the way they do that work or function. So the term ergon is frequently translated as function. For example, most translations, I actually don't know what Ostwald, how he translates it, but most translations, most discussions or translations of Nicomachean Ethics, Book 1, Chapter 7, translate ergon as function. It's referred to as the function argument, where you go from where Aristotle tries to argue that human beings have a function that is rational activity and so on and so forth. And then the Nicomachean Ethics is off and running. But ergon is actually related to the term energeia, which means activity. Right. So afunction refers to the work or activity that someone undertakes and the way they do that work or that activity. So it's an activity word. An agency word, and appropriate to apply to social agency. So artisanal, so the A function has this connotation of work and activity and way of doing things that function in other contexts doesn't necessarily carry. So artisanal functions or work are comprised of activities that are normatively accessible. There are different ways of engaging those activities. They can be performed well or badly, right? There are good or bad carpenters because some display a high degree of skill and others don't. And one thing that's important for the longer argument in my book is that the normativity of artisanal functions isn't purely instrumental. One might think that the norms are all and only about making the pot, or if you're a carpenter, making the chest of drawers. But it's not simply a matter, that is to say, the standard of excellence for being a good carpenter isn't simply a matter of instrumental goods, like delivering a good quality product. There are also aspects of skill and expertise that are local. They're the way we do things around here, the way we make pots around here. And these can't be cashed out in purely instrumental terms. So I want to emphasize in the notion of an A function, the idea that it involves activity, the idea that there are norms that aren't purely instrumental, but they're local. And I think that these are features of social normativity that are well captured by the vocabulary of A functions and the artisanal model.
Right. So let me ask to I hope that this is helping to fill in at least part of. So the A function is this sort of, it's energeia, it's activity, it's but it's also tied, I take it on your account and on Aristotle's account, to certain sort of affective states as well as
yes,
and what we think of in the narrow sense as skill. It involves a kind of not only attentive directedness towards certain kinds of features of what you're doing, but the practice of taking care or caring about, or being affectively engaged in the practice of the skill. Is that right?
Yes, that's absolutely right. It's affective engagement. It's not just a sort of mean stand stepwise instrumental production idea. It has this aspect of caring for, and of course, this fits very well with social roles because many of them have that feature as well. And so they captured that emotional, affective aspect of human social behavior, let's say. And also they allow for a value such as aesthetic values, which are important with regard to some social roles.
Right.
So there's a broader sense of value from sort of productivity or something like that.
Right, right.
There are these affective dimensions, and there are these aesthetic dimensions, in addition to and intermingled with more instrumental values.
I see. So just that, so I have a friend, a very good friend who I've been friends with since I was 2 years old, by the way, who's a chef and in New York. And by the way, his last name is Calamari.
Perfect.
So yeah, that was fate. But one of the things that your book got me thinking about is, he's up in New York, and when I visit him, we sometimes go to, not fancy places to eat, diners and things in New York and in northern New Jersey. But one of his regular critiques of food that we get at restaurants when I visit him is the guy cooking this didn't care. It's not, I'm like, oh, is the burger not good? He's, no, the burger's fine. It's, but I could just tell that he just didn't care. And so the artisanal model sort of got me thinking. I'm like, that is part of the excellence of being a line cook. Forget about chef.
Right.
Is a kind
caring.
Of,
yes.
Yeah, good. That's right. It's a kind of caring for not merely the product, because again, it's perfectly, Calamari, my friend, will always say it's perfectly fine. It's a good burger even, but It just, I can tell that there's just, it wasn't prepared with the right kind of attention and care. And your view, I think, really captures that. It captures that very nicely, it seems to me, that somebody can be evaluable even if we assess the product, the chest of drawers, the hamburger, the artistic performance of the concerto, right? If we accept as totally competent and not falling short with respect to just the properties that the product should have, there's this other sort of side of evaluation about the artisan's engagement with the process by which the totally competent product was created. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. And when you learn, one of the things that and I talk about this later, because this comes up with regard to critique, one of the things and change in norms, when you learn norms, let's say chef's norms, cooking norms, or others, it could be athletics. Yeah. And people say this about athletics all the time. You want your kid on a sports team, not so much that they learn how to play soccer, but that they learn what excellence is. And they learn what caring about the team, the game, you know, there's a whole bunch of more general values that are learned. And I think that's in alignment with what you were talking about, yeah, which is that this care is something that you learn by imitation, by habituation, by watching someone who's an expert, and basically learning through this habituation process, not just how to make a meatball, but how to have an attitude towards your making meatballs. You know what I mean?
No, exactly. It's exactly.
Yeah, it. No, I think that's absolutely true. Yeah.
That's fabulous. So can you tell us now about the sort of underlying ontology? So we've already got, we're already quantifying over things like functions, afunctions, roles, these kinds of things. So can you tell us a little bit about the kind of, you know, what the ontology of the social world looks like once we pick up this externalist and artisanal sort of view about social norms?
Right. So I had the moment of humility in working on the social ontology that underlies this artisanal model, because I was able to, I think, use the artisanal model and argue that it's not compatible with the current kind of ruling ontology of the social world that was, for example, associated with Searle, but other people as well, namely that the social world is made up of individuals. And so the explanation of social phenomena should be in terms of the behavior and attitudes of individuals. That's a quote from Sally Haslinger, right, describing methodological individualism, which had been the kind of the ruling ontology of the social world. So in social ontology, one major problem had been, you know, how do you get joint action? You have all these individuals, but if it's a social phenomena, there has to be some kind of joint action. But you can see there that the presupposition is all you've got to work with are individuals and their attitudes.
Right.
And what does it mean for them to do something together? And so there was a lot of energy and effort going into that kind of project. And I think that externalism and the artisanal model require requires a richer ontology,
sure,
than methodological individualism. And if I'm right, it also shows the limitations of methodological individualism. So at the end of the day, I'm only fully happy with the kind of negative critical part of my ontology. And this was one of those moments, which I'm sure you've had, Bob, where I just said to myself, philosophy is too hard. You know? It's like easy to be a critic, easy to say, oh, methodological individualism can't account for X, Y, and Z.
Right.
Much harder to work out in detail what you need to have if you want to refer to social positions, what you need to have if you want to refer to expertise and technique that is not reducible to the behavior and attitudes of individuals. And I say some things about expertise and technology, but technique, expertise and technique, and how they're related to one another, and how you can't really give a reduction to individuals, and so on and so forth. But I would say most of it is critical.
Right.
Other things that would be required ontologically, I mean, there's the idea that social roles are situated and material and world evolving means you have to go beyond individuals and their, you know, the methodological individualist view. So there's a lot of critique in that chapter, but I'm not sure that the positive ontology is fully worked out. That's what I would say.
And that's being a good critic is a perfectly honest day's work.
It is, but I had actually started out thinking, well, this is more about my biography writing the book, but you know, I realized that actually the critical job is easier.
That's true, but yeah. let me say what. So one of the things that I thought emerged very nicely in the critical discussion of the methodological individualist position is, you know, sometimes here's a little bit of autobiography of me as a philosopher. You know, sometimes I find that positions that are well entrenched in the discourse, that sort of are often so well entrenched that they're taken as the default position, sort of get the traction that they get by ways of processes that aren't really sensitive to philosophical merit.
So
sometimes, you know, one of the things that I think comes out of some of the critical maneuvers you make, and some similar I think fellow traveling critical maneuvers in Sally Hasselhoff's work, that you come to see how much of the ontology of the social world that sort of is driving the accounts that you get in someone like Searle, for example, they kind of like have their root in the force, the intuitive force of certain kinds of sort of toy examples. Like if we think that the place to start thinking about this is with money, for example, you know, you're going to get certain kinds of philosophical outputs fairly readily, but they're being driven not by what looks to me like that intuitive force sort of has behind it, you know, that you picked an example at the start that, you know, had a kind of, you know, that was easy to make good sense of. And then you say, well, but wait a minute, you know, if we start thinking about this question from a different standpoint, like, you know, the person featured in the image on the cover of your book, the potter, like, then it looks as if all of a sudden different kinds of philosophical thoughts become much more at hand.
There are more resources. Yes,
this seems to me exactly right. So sometimes the critical stuff really is a kind of is a much more creative and philosophically sort of fecund kind of process, because it makes you more aware of how the defaults were set by the intuitiveness of a certain kind of set of simple toy examples that underwrite, I think, a lot of the more individualistic views of our social world.
Right.
But once you see that those are just examples that were just picked out of thin air, it's like, well, you know, how well does the view, the more individualistic view, do at dealing with examples that the individualist theorist didn't handpick, seems to me to be the right kind of criterion. Does that sound right?
Right. Yeah, that sounds exactly right to me. And I think someplace I say, you know, trying to figure out the difference between a, you know, what makes a rock a border and why right. isn't it a border and all this, or what is it for two people to take a walk together and so on. They're very meager resources.
That's right.
To try to explain what we're addressing. It's so reductionist and gives you such little resources. You know, I don't want to be totally, as I said, you know, to go right. back to my whining, philosophy's hard. And, you know, in a way, you know, if some philosophers have a reductionist tendency, and if they can just have individuals, that would be good, and they don't want, you know, other things in their ontology. But I just feel like you're starting with such impoverished resources, toy examples, if you will, that you can't explain things that we're all very familiar with and that we want to understand and so on. So yeah,
that's right. That's
I really am sympathetic, and I do think in some ways it is a contribution to have a largely critical chapter or perspective, because it does help to shake some of the conversations at a meaningful place.
Right.
And so if you were going to ask me at the end of this, for example, you know, what do you see yourself doing in the future? I think work on this ontology is one of the places.
Nice. So you've been very generous with your time, and you know, we've got about 10 more minutes. This has gone by very quickly, by the way, for me, because the book is, you know, it's a short book, but it's philosophically, it's got a lot of depth. So I'm going to sort of lay out a couple of questions about the final couple chapters of the book, so 5, 6, and then the last chapter and the epilogue, you can decide, you know, how best to navigate the short version of the question is, can you tell us about the end of the book? But one way I'll sort of fill in a little bit of detail, so in chapter 5, you lay out in part in response to some worry that the artisanal model sort of looks like it's got inevitably has certain hierarchical elements in it. There are, you know, there are teachers and learners. There are the people who have already mastered the craft. There are the apprentices. And so in chapter 5, you're interested in showing that your model can accommodate the idea that we can be critical from the inside of the social roles. In chapter 6, you develop that insight into what looked to be totally intriguing conception of, again, it might even be right to call it sort of artistic self-creation. And then in the final chapter and in the epilogue, you're interested to fit your view of social norms and social role normativity into some of the themes that I know were more central to some recent previous work about oppressive social relations and hierarchical and further hierarchy unjust social relations. So can you in a compact way sort of round out those accounts? I know it's a tall order.
Yeah, so the one way to think about it is that the first three chapters of the book, I kind of lay out the positive view. And in the last three chapters of the book, I address what I think of as intuitive and important critical perspectives you might have on the proposed model. So in chapter 4, I talk about criticism and how someone who is habituated towards a certain social norm can, given the apprentice model of learning, given the idea that we learn by doing and we learn by imitating and by guided behavior. And so we get patterns. This actually goes back to the beginning of our conversation where we talk about how when the pattern is broken, we all sort of go, what?
Yeah.
because it's habitual and it's not articulated and it's something that we just do and we find appropriate and we do. And so if that's the case, then how do individuals who've been habituated have space for critical appraisal of the norms they stand under? And I think this is very important because, as I said, social role nonconformers are a very real and important sort of group to think about.
Sure.
I talk about that and I talk about it in a number of ways. I'll just mention one now just so I can get through some of the some more of the content. So one way to think about it is that when you become expert in something, you learn how to do things, but you also learn why you do them that way. And that pairing of know how and know why. So if you learn how to be a chef or a cook, you learn how to do certain things. For example, you know, you should weigh your ingredients. You shouldn't use a cup measurement. And you know why, and you can explain it. And that ability also gives you the ability to think about how you might improve it, to
right.
think about whether it really achieves the goal you want it to. So there's a bit of space for the expert, a bit of reflective space for criticism, improvement, and so on. So this, I use the Aristotelian terminology of, you know how and know why. And so that's a way that you can be a critic because you can say, you know, there's really a better way to do that. And in another chapter, I talk about another aspect of my view that people, I think, worry about unnecessarily, which is the idea that it's important for us to understand ourselves as creating lives for ourselves, as having some say in what it is that we value and where we're going to go in life. And some people think that because of the externalism, because of the fact that, you know, we're not thinking up all these norms for ourselves from the get-go, that ability to think of yourself as choosing and creating and making yourself, at least to some extent, anew, is missing. And so I argue that that's actually not true, that externalism actually is better than internalism in
right.
providing an account of how that happens. I think I'm going to move ahead.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I talk about how self-creation, in at least one sense of the term, is possible in my view. Meaning, and I've taught some of this material to my students, and they say, oh, yeah, I came to college, and I wasn't interested in academics, and then I took a class with Professor so-and-so, and
right.
I suddenly realized there's this other set of values, and, you know, I started to incorporate them. And so... So it's interesting to teach this kind of material to students because they're still at that point in their lives where they really do change their values and they really do take on new values. And how does that happen? It's interesting. The final chapter in my book also deals with some problems for my view that some people might find, which I don't obviously find quite as worrisome about the fact that social roles and social norms can be arranged in hierarchical and oppressive structures. And of course, that's true. And I came to this work actually from thinking about gender norms and gender oppression and such. So So one of the things that I think about that is that your account, if you your account needs to be adequate to the fact that these things exist. And it also is a question how an account of social norms might allow for change. And so what I try to do in that chapter is show where I think there is a hierarchical, kind of a hierarchical fixity to social roles, which is in the apprentice situation. So college students and professor, that kind of thing, or apprentice chef in a kitchen, where when the training process is going, when the learning is going on, when the habituation is happening. Yes, that's a that seems to me to be a hierarchical relationship, though I don't think it's necessarily oppressive. So I try to detach the idea that social roles are ontologically and normatively related to other social roles, that idea of a kind of a that there are systems of social roles, right? Where what the social role is and what the obligations are is determined in relation to other social roles. That sort of systematicity, right? That's one thing. Another thing is that often they are arranged in hierarchical structures. Like think about a building a house, and think about who, the contractor versus other people working on the house in other ways. And often these are arranged hierarchically. Or think about the structure of a philosophy department or an academic department where there's full professors and there's instructors and there's graduate students, and this is hierarchical. Could these be arranged in other ways? Yeah, they could be arranged in other ways. In fact, they're hierarchical in structure. That doesn't mean that they're also oppressive. So here I sort of wheel in social theory, feminist theory, theories of oppression, and or your work on democracy and democratic institutions. Can you have a workplace that's organized democratically? Do some exist? It would still be it could still be it doesn't need to be an oppressive structure, even if it's hierarchical. So I try to separate out these different ways in which social positions and roles can be related to one another, to, and my goal is to have both something descriptive of how social roles and social norms are related to one another in society. And then one can ask about change. So the theory has to both sort of capture our fallen world and also have some directionality in terms of how one might, or at least raise questions about how better to structure these workplaces, homes, families, how, whichever institution you want to talk about.
That all sounds good to me. Certainly the ambition to produce the kind of theory that you're aiming for seems to me to be a worthwhile a contribution to the debate. And I think you pull it off very nicely. But Charlotte, I want to thank you for your time today, and thank you for joining me on New Books in Philosophy. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you about your book.
Thanks, Bob. It's been fun talking.
Excellent. And before we go, let me thank our listeners. Thank you for joining us for this discussion. I've been talking to Charlotte Witt. Her new book, which is published with Oxford University Press, is titled Social Goodness: The Ontology of Social Norms. I highly recommend it. Thank you for listening to New Books in Philosophy, and bye for now.